Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Charmaine Craig. She is the author of Miss Burma. While she grew up in Santa Monica, her parents and grandparents were born in Burma. In fact, her mother was the first Miss Burma. Am I right?
Actually, there was some confusion about that. I had thought she might be the first Miss Burma because apparently a few people had told me she was. And then out of the woodwork, I got an email from somebody who said, in fact, his mother was Miss Burma before my mother was Miss Burma. So she was one of the first, among the first, but not the first Miss Burma.
Fascinating. Because, you see, it brings up an immediate question. Is a historical novel, and this is a historical novel, a factual novel, I would say that this historical novel is a novel of moods and an attempt to understand what can't really be understood, which is the moods and the whims of another time. What do you think?
I think when I set out to write this book, my priority, my interest was not in the facts, as you use that word, not in the ashes, if you will, of the past, but rather in that sort of eternal fire, that which is more immutable. I certainly did want to capture the moods of the past. Increasingly, though, it became important for me to get as many of those facts right as I could.
What the book did, at least for me, was to ask whether we could know the spirituality of Burma, a place where there are many populations, many religions. It housed the world's longest civil war. It's a place where extraordinarily improbable things are happening. You know, it is a world that you're conjuring up. In South Pacific, there's some lyric that goes, they have mangoes and bananas you can pick right off the tree. Mm-hmm. But they sure do. They mm-hmm. have mangoes and bananas, yes, and a river that flows through the lot, and this beauty contest where rich and poor, Christian and non-Christian, all are vying for a possibility of grace that life doesn't often offer. Mm-hmm. And I think that grace is often the subject of this book.
I think you're right. It was something that was on my mind. I'm always interested in finding the unexpected in a moment and in a scenario. And it was so important to me not to truck into sort of the orientalist tropes of the mangoes and the bananas that you could pick off a tree, and in sort of the exotic splendor, if you will, of my mother having been Miss Burma.
I noticed in the final pages of the book, as they are leaving Burma, the characters are experiencing what feels to them like an experience of grace. Mm. And I was fascinated because, you see, you'll pardon me, I hope, but I didn't find this to be a historical novel. Well, of course it's a historical novel. It takes place in the past. But it seemed to me to be asking a question about spirituality and about how people who are essentially at war with each other, what it is that would unify them other than declarations of peace or lists of affirmation? What is it? In a country like Burma, the civil war there, I sense, is not different from the claims of ethnic cleansing now. This is a country that has always been seeking some way of defining itself, of knowing who it is, and of trying to unify, but not out of a desire for sameness, but a desire to create empathetic interaction amongst populations. In other words, not different from us, huh?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that it is a country that for so long, at least since the early 1900s, has been grappling with this question of, you know, ethnic majority nationalism and how to achieve pluralism in the face of ethnic majority, really supremacy, or an instinct for supremacy, and that in the novel, the question that kind of recurs, and I'm so glad that you said you don't think of this as a historical novel, because actually I don't really either, that the question that recurs in the novel is how to go on in the face of this kind of inter-ethnic strife, in this kind of this presence of this sort of almost eternal presence, it seems, of discrimination. And why should one try to resist discriminatory powers if that means just sort of risking one's little corner of happiness? And in the end, I think it is a spiritual book because there aren't any concrete, I think, or pat answers. But one of the answers that some of my characters arrive at, if implicitly, is to serve others.
This book, again, for a so-called historical novel, has a very limited cast of characters, really. It's Miss Burma herself, Louisa, her mother, who is Kin. Her father, who is
Benny.
And they are the central characters. Benny gets released from prison. He's been tortured. And his wife is looking at what his body has become.
Right.
She does not leave him, although they no longer share beds. He, looking at her, knows that at least one of two men has had an affair with her and fathered a child while he's been away in prison. The issues of trust, of grace, of how can a person do this to another person, and not just betray another person, but torture another person. During the sequence, it's revealed that genital torture is an especial favorite of the Japanese, and they've taught it to their victims. So we're seeing very unusual and shocking and previously, I'd say, unexamined materials in this book, Miss Burma, which on the surface is giving us the romance of a beauty contest. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. We're talking about Miss Burma. It's a novel by Charmaine Craig. Did you ever live in Burma?
No, my, you know, the novel is really drawn from the actual stories of my mother and her parents, and my mother had a price on her head because she was considered an enemy of the state. You know, my father was American, and I was born in the United States, and I had the opportunity to go sort of through the backside, through refugee areas to Burma twice. in my life, but both times really very much under under the radar.
One of the subjects of the book, just as I feel that spirituality is a subject, the book is also trying to piece together the difference between the genuine and the artificial. There are all sorts of artifactual behaviors that are mastered in the process of becoming a movie star. She first becomes Miss Burma, then she becomes a movie star in Burma, and then she becomes a warrior. She, when her husband dies, she takes on his army and becomes the leader of a resistance movement. And the question this book asks is, who is she? These are all roles, but who is she?
And that was the question that I was really asking myself during the writing of the book, and that I've asked myself for a lot of my life, because my mother, like the character, really was those things. And yet the mother that I knew seemed to be none of those things, meaning that she was a pacifist, she didn't seek out attention, she professed to be embarrassed about having been a beauty queen and even an actress. She would say things like, I don't understand why I would have been so famous, or I would have been such a beloved national figure, especially given her minority status, especially given the fact that her father was considered an enemy of the state. So in a way, for me, part of writing the book was seeking to find answers to the questions of who is she. When my mother talked about all of this, she spoke about it as if, almost as if it was fate that had drawn her from point to point.
I'm not the most geographically minded person in the world, but I'm not the least. But I did have to go to an atlas and look and see, where is Burma? So why don't we almost take a step back and tell our listeners, where is Burma?
Okay. Well, Burma is sort of wedged between Thailand and India, China and Bangladesh, if you can imagine that.
How would you describe the Burma that you're writing about?
Well, it took me a while, I should say, to piece together that Burma myself, Michael. It's not surprising. I mean, it's not surprising at all that people might not know very much about Burma's history or ethnic makeup, because really, even the people within Burma have had their history suppressed in a way. For hundreds of years before the British began to annex what is now modern Burma in the 1800s. My mother's people, the Karen, who were one of Burma's indigenous peoples and long persecuted peoples, were enslaved by the ethnic majority leaders. And that ethnic majority, they're called the Burmans, or their word for themselves is the Bamar, or their elevated literary word for themselves is Myanmar. So that explains the contemporary word for the country.
Myanmar.
Yes, it would be as if we changed the United States name to White Land. But during that period, that long period of enslavement, if Karens were found with writing implements on their person, their hands were cut off, such that they lost their written language, they lost their written history, their spiritual texts. And so it was only when the British began to, again, to annex the territories that the Karens experienced an extraordinary liberation from that state of enslavement. So for them, one of the things that was a little unexpected for me as I began to write the book was that their attitudes about colonialism don't square with those attitudes that I, as a sort of post-nationalist, post-colonialist person, had encountered before. Within the British system, they experienced an elevation of status and a freedom that then was absolutely lost all over again when the country gained independence in 1948 and the ethnic majority regained leadership of the country. And suddenly all sorts of anti-minority acts were passed and minority villages were, you know, targeted, et cetera, et cetera. It's what we're seeing happening today.
See, what one always fears about a historical novel is that without my context in front of me, I'm not going to know where I am or how I got there. The amazing thing about Miss Burma is that we're reading about events that took place over and over and over again. And so we're really talking about history as it is inscribed into the soul of peoples.
If people don't understand or aren't nationalistic before genocide, once they experience genocide to a certain extent, ethnic nationalism can become their fate. And so on the other hand, there's an eternal question, at least among the Karenin in the book, I hope, which is how does one prevail over this knee-jerk instinct and this reaction of ethnic nationalism in the face of genocide? Is it possible to trust? And so you mentioned trust before as being a theme in the book between the characters, and it very much is on the kind of the intimate interpersonal level, but it also is sort of in a more macro people-to-people level in the book, because over and over again, the ethnic minority peoples are burned by when they trust, when they try to dialogue with the majority leaders, they're burned.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Charmaine Craig about her book, Miss Burma. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Charmaine Craig about her latest book, Miss Burma, detailing the makings of modern Burma through a beauty queen and her family's turmoil. This is Charmaine Craig reading from Miss Burma.
That feeling of renewed appreciation for his wife, of closeness with her, only grew when at last the stadium lights went dim, and a hush came over the assembled thousands, and sweet music began to sound over the loudspeaker. It wasn't long before yellow floodlights shot up from the stage, and then a procession of bathing-costumed girls appeared before them. Many of these girls, he saw with a pang of sympathy, were too heavily made up. Most wore smiles that were too theatrical. Some tottered and swung their hips as though to impersonate feminine confidence and magnetism. Others cast defeated glances at the audience, or blinked out at the darkness as if to find reassurance there. Then Louisa emerged, in a simple white suit, and it was as if a switch were thrown. And was some amplification of lighting responsible for her skin appearing so luminous? Her smile seemed to reach out past him and across the stadium, to reach out, as if to fling the gates open and let everyone in. Who was this creature? He was still asking himself a quarter hour later, when Louisa was invited to present herself uniquely to the judges. Who had taught her to move on those gold heels? Not cheaply or brashly, not frantically. No, there wasn't a tense or a natural note in the way she fell into a smile, cast her eyes over the stands, turned, looked with another unabashed glance back at the audience. Here, rather, was a young woman radiant with self-possession. Yes, this was precisely what distinguished her from the rest. Not the mechanics of her beauty, the way her eyes were set above the sculpture of her cheekbones, or the voluptuousness that Benny preferred not to notice. All of these girls were knockouts, mechanically speaking. Rather, what distinguished her was what she did with her looks, disregarded them, so that the outer luminosity gave way to a more resplendent inner one. Wasn't it a truism that a virtue was a virtue only by dint of its keeper's unconsciousness of it? And didn't she seem to be unself-consciousness made manifest? a sort of heavenly body, obediently prepared to shine on for the others, spinning and circling around her composure, until the light of that composure must finally perish. "I give you my light," she seemed to communicate, "that you might have a measure of grace. I give you my naturalness, that you might see a simpler, more natural life, one unspotted by the shadows of divisiveness. Yes, I have the blood of various peoples coursing through my veins, but what of it? We are all various. Don't despair. Stop these arguments. Content yourself with enchantment."
Thank you. That was Charmaine Craig reading a section of Miss Burma. They're all enacting something that is not Burma. It's a fantasy about Burma.
Yes.
And the minute she has chosen Miss Burma, the newspapers have at her. They say that she is the mistress. She's been seen leaving the home of the dictator, that she's been driving in a car with him, and that this becomes all the more reason for her to become a movie star. So the novel, I'd say, is a kind of fantasy about the hallucination of Burma.
That's interesting.
Do you know what I mean, though? It's not giving us events by the years. It's events by the images and the dreams and the ways in which these different populations are all seeking survival, but never through honesty or trustworthiness or a speaking of what, who are you? Who am I? Who are we together? There's never a League of Nations. It's right. Just a strange kind of world in which things can be avoided.
I mean, I think absolutely that at the core of things in the book, miscommunication and the almost the impossibility of perfect fluency and perfect understanding is a subject. Even the first two of the lead characters whom you mentioned, Benny and Kin, who are married, can't converse at the beginning of their relationship. They speak different languages. And not only the language barrier, but their sort of their the cultural barriers, but just also the divide between them as humans makes for a plethora of misunderstandings. And I think that is part of the way that we see, I hope, in the book, the sort of most private experiences of each of these characters as a reflection of the larger cultural misunderstandings that are happening in the book, or the larger breaches of faith and fluency.
I had never quite understood in-house imprisonment as a metaphor before. But it's as if your Burma is a vast in-house imprisonment.
Exactly.
That's an astounding way to write a novel. Novels usually ask, how do I bring these characters together? How can I bring them into proximity, cause them to be revealing or intimate to one another? Your novel seems to see how to keep them apart, how the very place is a place that keeps peoples separate.
I think the way that I thought of it more was a question of belonging. You know, for example, the Karens are indigenous to Burma, probably one of Burma's first peoples, if not their first, and yet they don't belong anymore to Burma, to this place that wants them gone. We see today, of course, the Rohingya being, you know, ethnic cleansing, if not genocide, going on, where they're being forcibly expelled from the country. But then the characters, my grandfather, the character of Benny, is orphaned at an early age, loses his Jewish community, loses his Many of the Jews, by the way, were forced to flee during World War II from Rangoon to go to India. And so there's this unending for so many of the characters and peoples question of, is belonging even a possibility? And yet, for the Karen people, interestingly, truthfully, one of their central values is once you belong to us, you belong to us. It doesn't matter what your religion is. It doesn't matter what your race is. We will consider you a Karen. That was an interesting kind of solution to me.
Fascinating, because Benny's grandfather, I believe, was the rabbi in the oldest synagogue in Burma.
Yes.
And yet I didn't know there were synagogues. Mm-hmm. The whole book kept unfolding in ways that involved revelations, showing me that when I read a historical novel, I don't even know where I'm beginning, that the book only gives me the place in its last pages, and then reading it again, I might be able to understand why it is that it's so hard to understand the place, why history is a concealment rather than a revelation.
That's beautifully said, Michael.
Oh, thank you, Charmaine. Thank you very much. I've been talking with Charmaine Craig, author of Miss Burma, published by Grove Press, an extraordinary novel bearing with it the elements of historical novel, spiritual novel, novel of psychology and character and legend, folktale. Thank you, Charmaine, for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's been so nice, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Miss Burma at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone app. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is today's producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm, when Anne Fadiman is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.